Okay, so we're still, very surprisingly, on the first section of Daniel chapter 1, verses 1 through 7, but we are ready for the very last question. He actually has two questions embedded in that little paragraph. So before we hit those, let me just read the first seven verses again of Daniel chapter 1. Daniel writes, "In the third year of the reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the vessels of the house of God. And he brought them to the land of Shinar, to the house of his God, and placed the vessels in the treasury of his God. Then the king commanded Ashpenaz, his chief eunuch, to bring some of the people of Israel, both of the royal family and of the nobility, youths without blemish." That's youths, not E-W-E-S. Okay, yes. "Youths without blemish, of good appearance and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace, and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. The king assigned them a daily portion of the food that the king ate and of the wine that he drank. They were to be educated for 3 years, and at the end of that time, they were to stand before the king. Among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. And the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah he called Shadrach. Mishael he called Meshach. And Azariah he called Abednego." Okay, now we are ready for that question down at the bottom of page 12. In our notebook. The author writes this. He asks, "Why does Nebuchadnezzar go to all the trouble of deporting some of the Jews to Babylon? What strategy might he have in deporting members of the royal family and nobility in particular, and then training them in the culture and customs of the Babylonians, as well as providing for them materially?" So that first question, why does Nebuchadnezzar go to all the trouble of deporting some of the Jews to Babylon? What did you guys write? Yes, Ryan.
Is it because when you talked about Jeremiah, where he said where God was telling people don't rebel against them, do everything on them?
Well, that would be what the exiles are supposed to do in Babylon. But this question is, put yourself in Nebuchadnezzar's shoes or sandals or whatever, and ask yourself, why go to all the trouble to bring these people from Jerusalem to Babylon? Have any ideas? Got any good guesses? Mary, you were poised and ready to go, it looked like. Right, but clearly, as you read through here, his purpose, his intent wasn't as slaves. Yes, certainly, if you're going to significantly increase the labor force and it's free labor, that might be some motivation. But that's not the case here. So, No. That's the second question. That's the second question in the paragraph. That's the second question in the answer. That's the second. Thank you. Something like that.
Are you asking why the sum? Why only do it part?
No, I'm asking why do it at all. And I'm not asking that, the author is, right? Isn't that the way you guys take the question?
I thought we were keying in on the fact that it
No, that's what we keyed in. That's what you asked about last week. But we put a period on that conversation last week. Well, looks like you guys are all poised to answer that question, second question. The first question, he's just asking, why bring anybody? You know, why go to all that trouble?
He's trying to disarm the enemy. He's trying to just make sure that they don't, you know, revive and have any leadership.
Bingo. Deportation was meant to weaken the defeated nation. Okay? And assimilate its people into the conquering nation. Now we get to the question that you all are chomping at the bit to answer. No. Okay. Well, you stuck your tongue out at me. What might be the strategy in deporting members of the royal family and the nobility in particular? Why did he go after them? What might his strategy be in taking them?
I think it has to do with assimilating anything that was of the value that was at the top of the nation and saying, okay, here's what we've got. How can I, as the conquering king, take that and turn it from what was against me to using it for my king?
Yeah, so think about this. He goes in and defeats a nation and he takes all of its leadership. What's that going to do to the nation when he leaves? The rest of the nation that's left behind. You know, every State of the Union address, this does relate. Every State of the Union address, they have what is called the designated survivor out of the president's cabinet, okay, that's taken off to a safe room. So in the event that there's catastrophic attack on the Capitol building, they would have at least one out of the cabinet left over. But say that happens. What does that do to the nation? Say that happens, the Capitol is attacked and that designated survivor is the only one left. What does that do to the nation? Right, it does. So I think what Seth is saying is by targeting the nation's elite, Nebuchadnezzar was dismantling dismantling the political and financial organization of the nation. That's a good way of hamstringing the nation, isn't it? Can you think of one other? That's a consequence for the defeated nation. Might there be a consequence for the conquering nation? Might there be he's trying to extract a benefit for his nation? What might that be? Yeah, look in verse 4. Here's the requirement. Youths without blemish, of good appearance, and skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent to stand in the king's palace and to teach them the literature and language of the Chaldeans. So essentially, he's, by taking the best of the best, he's crippling the financial and leadership of the defeated nation, and he's, in his mind, hopefully strengthening his power by adding talent to his administration. Okay? So you see that? Okay, good. Great answers. Oh. Well, sure, and I mean, that would have been clearly communicated to them by him taking the temple vessels and sticking them in the treasury of his God, my God be your God, and then Jehoiakim. I think it was in the second wave of the conquest. Jehoiakim was taken. His sons were slaughtered before his eyes, and then his eyes were gouged out, and he was taken to Babylon. You know, that communicates something to the people. Sure. Okay. So now we get to any other questions on those first seven verses? Now we get to that second section, verses 8 through 16. Let me read those verses. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food or with the wine that he drank. Therefore he asked the chief of the eunuchs to allow him not to defile himself. And God gave Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the chief eunuchs. And he turned him down. Do you ever get that? How's that? Anyway. And the chief of the eunuchs said to Daniel, I fear my lord the king who assigned your food and your drink. For why should he see that you were in worse condition than the youths who are of your own age? So you would endanger my head with the king. Then Daniel said to the steward, whom the chief of the eunuchs had assigned over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, test your servants for 10 days. Let us be given vegetables to eat and water to drink. Then let our appearance and the appearance of the youths who eat the king's food be observed by you, and deal with your servants according to what you see. So we listened to them in this matter, and tested them for 10 days. At the end of 10 days, it was seen that they were better in appearance and fatter in flesh than all the youths who ate the king's food. So the steward took away their food and the wine they were to drink and gave them vegetables. Okay, this is a section where a lot of people are really wanting to get to. First paragraph in the notebook, in the that on page 13 in the notebook under section 2. Notice how verse 8 begins with a sharp contrast. But Daniel resolved that he would not defile himself with the king's food. Why did Daniel believe eating the king's food or drinking his wine would defile him? Would y'all put down there? I'm sure it's right, whatever you have. Truly. Dietary laws. That's one of the views that's put forward, and that could very easily explain part of it. Here's the part. I mean, because the Babylonians would eat pork and other things that don't fit into the dietary laws. But what about the wine? Read the dietary laws. It's the dietary laws didn't stop them from drinking wine. So it might be a partial answer, but it's certainly not the full explanation. That's another good one. Yeah, that would be the dietary view. That would be the symbolic view. I'm dependent upon the king of Babylon, meals in the ancient Near East indicated fellowship. And so I'm eating from the king's table and drinking his wine. So it's a symbol of fellowship with the king, sharing with the king and dependent on the king. There's the one problem with that view is the vegetables and water that they got was also, those were government issue as well. That's the problem with that view. But that is a view that's definitely put forth. There's still three other views that are put forth on here. We've looked at the dietary reason, the symbolic reason, don't want to depend on the king. Nazarite vow?
The vow where they didn't cut their hair.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, but didn't Paul take that vow at one time?
I think he did. I'm trying. Well, he took some vow in the book of Acts. You read about that. Well, the only problem is we're not told about that. Not only are we told that they're not told that they were under a vow, but we're not given any indication of them ending the vow. And certainly, by chapter 10, verse 3, that seems to indicate that Daniel was probably eating of the king's food and all of that. Daniel 10, verse 3. This is when he got his last vision. 10 through 12 is all one unit. It's about his last vision. And in verse 2, he says, "In those days I, Daniel, was mourning for 3 weeks. I ate no delicacies, no meat or wine entered my mouth." So that he had been eating meat and drinking wine. Another view that's put forward is that they were afraid they'd be eating food that was offered to idols. Because not only do you offer animal sacrifices, but you offer libations, which are drink sacrifices. So that's another view that's put forward. Here's the problem with that. That word vegetables, he's asked for vegetables. That's not exactly an accurate translation of that Hebrew word. That Hebrew word vegetable means any plant food. So it would include grains and fruit, as well as vegetables. And sometimes it even includes bread, because bread is made from grains. Certainly, grains would have been a part of sacrifices to the gods and all of that. So there's absolutely zero guarantee that switching to plant food, that would be a better translation than vegetables. Switching to plant food would not preclude eating food that's been offered to idols. Now, by restricting himself to plant food, they might reduce the amount of food that's been offered to idols, but it wouldn't eliminate it all. So that couldn't be a complete explanation either. So there's the dietary reason, dietary laws, Jewish laws. No, because they didn't restrict them from drinking wine. There is the symbolic view that they would have been sharing in the king's table, and so is symbolic of fellowship with the king and being totally dependent on him. The problem with that is the plant food and water would have been government issue as well. And there is the religious view that it might be foods offered to the gods. Well, that broad term plant food, that doesn't provide any guarantees that it wouldn't be food offered to the gods. Come on, you guys. I know there's a view that you've heard of that's very obvious to you that you just are not sharing. Like the Daniel fast? I mean, that is a popular view. There's lots. There's the Daniel fast. There's the Daniel diet. Pardon? No. Well, that would mean that you wouldn't have meat. And so what you have book after book after book that purports. There's a couple of different approaches. There's books that purport the Daniel diet. And then there's books that purport the Daniel fast. Okay. The Daniel diet, they say it's healthy to be a vegetarian. And two problems with that. There's no way Daniel would have thought that eating a non-vegetarian diet would defile him, because there is nothing in the Old Testament laws that would say that. That's a modern view that meat is bad for you, and it's definitely not in the Old Testament laws. So for Daniel to think that it would defile him, it doesn't fit the picture. You know. Now, if Daniel had read a book that was written 2,000 years after him and thought that vegetarian diet would be good, that'd be a different thing. But what he says is he doesn't want to be defiled. And there's nothing like that in the Old Testament law. So it's not, that's the health reason. And the Daniel diet, the Daniel fast, here's the thing. Here's what's going on. They're going to Daniel 10, and they're reading back into Daniel 1 that he's fasting. In Daniel 10, he was mourning over what he had learned in the visions of Daniel 9, okay? He was in mourning. And so he was not eating any meat, any delicacy, drinking any wine, and all that. That's not what Daniel 1 says. It says he didn't want to defile himself. There's no mention of a fast here. And it goes on for 3 years. So to read a fast into Daniel 1 is just that. It's to go to Daniel 10 and read Daniel 10 back into Daniel 1. Does that make sense? So I think you're hard-pressed to say that he's fasting for 3 years in Daniel 1. Okay, I don't think the text fits that. And I clearly don't think I clearly think it's ridiculous to think that he's saying that a vegetarian diet is the best diet. Because he says he didn't want to defile himself, and there is nothing in the Old Testament laws that would have brought him to the conclusion that he would defile himself by eating meat, unless it was non-kosher meat. Okay? Julie. I'm not so sure that it would be how it's prepared. I mean, clearly what we're doing here, we're not told what, you know, why he thought it would defile him, but clearly we're trying to figure it out. So there's a certain amount of guesswork here, right? And I can't think of anything in the Old Testament laws that would preclude, that would outlaw eating certain kosher meats that were prepared a certain way. You know, can you think of any laws like that? They're kosher meats, but they were prepared the wrong way. I mean, they weren't supposed to eat it with the blood left in. Right. Right. I mean, that's in the dietary laws. But the reason that would not be a full explanation is because he didn't want to drink any wine either. He felt he would defile himself by drinking the wine, and that's not part of the dietary laws. So there's, obviously we're not told, that's why everybody's flailing around and coming up with all of these views. The view that I think is the best is what's called the defensive view. Let me read Walton in the IVP Bible Background Commentary puts it this way. He says, it is not so much in the food that defiles as much as it is the total program of assimilation. At this point, the Babylonian government is exercising control over every aspect of their lives. They have little means. We're talking about 15-year-old boys here, you know. They have little means to resist the forces of assimilation that are controlling them. They seize on one of the few areas where they can still exercise choice as an opportunity to preserve their distinct identity as Jews, as God's people. And I think that's probably the most likely thing that's going on. It wasn't so much that he felt he would defile himself. I mean, there's the possibility. It could be pork. It could have been offered to gods. Surely he's depending on Nebuchadnezzar, but that's going to happen no matter what. And all of that. Yes, there may be some of those elements all in there, but the primary thing, I think they're right, is that it is a defensive measure to reserve or preserve some of their distinctiveness as the nation of God. Right, in a sense, yeah, in a sense, yeah, they're maintaining their so everybody else is eating from the king's table, they're eating vegetables and water, so they're maintaining some sense of distinction from them, which is what they were about. A lot of the Jewish laws were about God maintaining them as a distinct nation in the world. Not to lift their nose at everybody, but to pursue God and to be a light to the Gentiles. Yes, Ryan.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, about the most that we can conclude with certainty here is that those four didn't. Right. Don't know about any of the other Jewish youths. But those four did. Now, pardon? Oh, but the problem is there's tons of answers to it. There's a whole market that addresses that question. Well, it's not just me. If you read the commentators, they all go through that. But I mean, haven't you seen the books, the Daniel diet, the Daniel fast, and all of that? So there's a whole market built on that. And so that's why we're going to say, that doesn't really fit. Pardon, Mary? Yes. Yeah. So it's a way of them resisting total assimilation. And so think about that. Every day, day in, day out, for 3 years, everybody else in that assimilation program are eating from the king's table. They're eating plant food and water. So that distinction is before them. And they will be reminded of that. They probably feared just being totally overwhelmed by Babylonian culture and totally absorbed into it. Now, let me give you one other line of evidence. I haven't mentioned this before, that I think strengthens this idea that that's what they were doing, that it was a defensive posture. They were resisting total assimilation. Here's the other reason. It's subtle, okay, but I think it's there, and that is, you notice we see it emerge in verses 7 and 8. Verse 7, the chief of the eunuchs gave them names. He called Belteshazzar, Hananiah, Shadrach, Mishael, Meshach, Azariah, Abednego. Now, two things here that I want to point out. And it's in these two verses plus verse 11. Two things I want to point out about that. Actually, three things. First of all, there's a play of words going on in verses 7 and 8. Because here's the way the Hebrew reads. In verse 7, the chief of the eunuchs settled names on them. He settled the name of Belteshazzar on Daniel. Then verse 8, the word resolve is, but Daniel settled in his heart that he would not defile himself. Same Hebrew verbs. There's a play of words. The chief eunuch settled on them Babylonian names. He settled on Daniel. Belteshazzar, Daniel settled on his heart that he's not going to be defiled by total assimilation into the Babylonian kingdom. Okay, now, two things I want to point out about that. They were named in verse 7. So what names does Daniel use in verse 11? They're Hebrew names. What names does Daniel use in chapter 2, verse 17? They're Hebrew names. Finally, at the end of chapter 2, he uses, in verse 49, he uses their Babylonian names. And then, of course, they're referred to, his three friends are referred to by their Babylonian names in chapter 3. But there's one more little subtle evidence that he's resisting. Even in the Babylonian names, those are not, from what I've read in the commentaries on the Hebrew, those are altered names. So even when in here, when he presents the Babylonian names, he alters them. He edits the name so it's not the true Babylonian name. For instance, probably the name that he settled on Daniel is the same name as the king in Daniel chapter 5, Belshazzar. But Daniel adds the consonant that corresponds to the English T. I don't know the Hebrew, so I'm just repeating what I read. Belteshazzar. In Meshach, he uses a CH instead of a K. In Abednego, the name of the god is Nebo, not Nego, but he alters it from Nebo to Nego. So you can read Steinman, which is probably one of the top exegetical commentaries on the Hebrew there, and he'll go through all of just how Daniel altered those names. So I think that's pretty slick, you know. He doesn't use the Babylonian names that they're given until the end of chapter 2 and in chapter 3. And whenever he uses the Babylonian names, he always uses the names that he altered. So I just think it's a subtle picture of resistance there. You're going to settle that name on you, on me? I'm going to change it. I'm not going to use it, or I'm going to change it. One of the others. One of those two things. So it's kind of a subtle resistance of being assimilated into Babylonian culture. You guys might not think that's a whole lot of fun, but I do. I thought that was pretty clever on Daniel's. Yes. Right. Yes, exactly. And Daniel refers to himself as his Hebrew name almost everywhere in the book. Yeah, so I'm sure that's why. But it's part of that defensive, it's part of that defensive posture. Yeah, and I think it's also a miracle. yeah. Right. Well, and the Hebrew word for fatter actually means healthier. So it would be like fitter. I mean, you know, 10 days. And they were wildly distinguishable from everybody else. No, that's a miracle.
So, keeping with the defensive view, then it could have been reversed. He could have made everybody vegetables and water, and they could have said, "No, no, no, we want meat and wine."
He could have, yeah.
Okay, so
but
just make sure I'm grasping the
right.
Concept.
But it would have been. What you mean to say is, if Nebuchadnezzar had ordered. But it's, right, it was not so much, it's true that the Babylonians eat meat that's not kosher, pork, you know, meat from animals with the cloven hoof and all that sort of stuff. That don't fit the dietary laws. It's true. They eat food and grains and stuff like that, and drinks that are offered to the idols. And all that. It's true that all of these captives in this assimilation program were totally dependent upon the king. Everything was government issue. And it turns out even the names were government issue. And so right in the midst of all of that, the chief eunuch settles Babylonian names on him. He settled this certain name on Daniel, and Daniel settles on his heart that he's going to resist total assimilation because he feels he's going to be defiled if he's just totally, completely assimilated into Babylonian culture. He's afraid of that. And so he comes up with this plan, with this request and this plan. And God gives him favor. Now, let's take a step back and look at that. So, what's the takeaway here? Is it really the Daniel fast or the Daniel diet? No, no matter how much Wes says yes. That's not the takeaway here. Daniel and his friends were jerked out of Jerusalem and plopped down in the midst of an anti-God culture and were being shoved into a total assimilation program, and they decided to resist. And that's the way we see them offering up what little resistance that they can. I mean, they don't have many, there's not much resistance they can put up, right? They're 15-year-old boys in the midst of the mightiest empire on the planet and being required to go through this assimilation program. So wherever they could, they put up resistance. They wanted to maintain their distinction by what they ate, and they even played with their names that were given to indicate some sort of resistance. So how does that transfer to us? Yeah, in the world, you're saying? Yeah, exactly. We're in the midst of an anti-God, anti-Christ culture, aren't we? Yes, just like the Colorado baker, yeah. Right. In that case, it's costing him quite a bit. He's not going to give tacit support to same-sex marriage by specifically baking a cake with a specific message that it's not baking the cake, it's the message that they want on the cake. That's the issue. It is a deceptive spin to say he is so anti-loving he wouldn't even bake him a cake. He offered to bake him a cake, just not put the message on it. But the person that requested it, that was the driving point, was the message. Turns out that person has done it multiple, hundreds of times to this same exact baker. It's just dogging him. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So let me ask this. So how do we resist? What does it look like? Can you think, let me put it this way, can you think of some scriptural passages that would indicate how we are to resist? Bumper stickers. Okay. Yeah. And that's in Hezekiah 3. Any passages come to mind? What about Romans 12, the first two verses? What's that say? It says more than that. Yeah, exactly. Do not be conformed to this world. Well, how in the world do you just walk around thinking, I'm not going to be conformed? How do you not be conformed to this world? What does the verse go on to say? Be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Exactly. What about a passage like 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verses 29 through 31? Somebody want to read that? It's 7 verses 29 through 31. You are?
Weep as though they did not weep, and those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, and those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use the world as though they did not make full use of it. For the form of this world is passing away.
Right. So Paul's point here. Pardon? Yeah, you can say, don't take the mark of the beast. His point here is to remember that the form of this world, its daily affairs, are passing away. And yet it's so easy to get caught up and treat them like they're everything, right? I got to do this. I got to do that. I've got 100 things I've got to do before I die. There's got to be things I got to see or do or taste before I die. Otherwise, my life is totally meaningless. There's books like that, right? All kinds of them out on the market. I think you're right about that. Right. Here's what I think is the major issue in the Western church. We have a heretical view of the kingdom of God. This is how we view the kingdom of God. The American dream with heaven at the end. That's, in this country, you'd be surprised at how pervasive that approach is to the kingdom of God. Not that people would verbalize it that way, but we live like it. Ryan.
I like what Jesus was saying in Matthew 6, verses 19 through 24, when he's talking to the people, don't lay up your treasures on earth, for moths can eat that and the rest can destroy that, and you can take and lay up your treasures in heaven, and none of that happens.
Right. Exactly. Yes. Right. 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 So is that to say, though, that we don't concern ourselves with the practical everyday affairs of life? No. in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter what house we live in. In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter whether we buy clothes from, from Nordstrom or from Walmart or Costco. In the grand scheme of things, those things are very, very fleeting. And we need to live like that. That's one of the ways that we resist being conformed to this world. There's three other passages, but two other passages in particular. I mean, the other passage you can write down is 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. But the other two passages I want to mention is, one of them is one that Wes was on this morning, Romans 8, 5 and 6. Paul says, "For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit set their minds on the things of the Spirit. For to set the mind on the flesh is death, but to set the mind on the Spirit is life and peace." And Wes explained this morning that this verb, phroneo, that's being used here, the whole idea is you are orienting your whole life. It's not just your thought life, but it's how you orient your entire life. He's saying those who are believers and have been regenerated and have the Spirit indwelling them, they orient their entire life toward the things of the Spirit. Okay? The unsaved, whose love is turned back on themselves and away from God, they orient their whole lives toward satisfying their own fleshly desires. Colossians chapter 3, we looked at that last year. Colossians chapter 3 uses the same verb. First four verses, but in particular verse 2. "If then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on the things that are above, not on the things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, appears, then you also will appear with him in glory." So, you are seated above in Christ. Orient your entire lives around heavenly things, the kingdom of Christ, spiritual things. That's what Paul is saying, both in Romans 8, 5 and 6, and Colossians 3, 1 through 4. That's how we resist. It's not the Daniel fast or the Daniel diet. We're not resisting total assimilation into the world by changing what we eat. It's how we orient our lives. To me, that's the real takeaway from this section in Daniel. We saw 15-year-old boys acting that out right in the face of the hairy-chested, macho brute of the world and his most powerful machine that's trying to totally assimilate them into Babylonian culture. They stood up, said, "No, we're going to preserve our distinctive identity as much as we can, as much as we have control of. We're going to preserve our distinctive identity as the people of God. And this is the way we're going to do it." So he proposes that plan. And by the way, I'm going to mess with the names you gave me too. Anyway, that's my takeaways. This one last paragraph here on section two. Well, before I go on, is there any questions about that? I mean, did that make sense to you? Okay. Verse 9 tells us that God gave Daniel favor and compassion. How does the Lord's favor and compassion manifest itself in Daniel's life in these verses? Now, he's talking about verses 8 through 16. Okay, that's the section we're on. So in verses 8 through 16, how does the Lord's favor and compassion manifest itself in Daniel's life in these verses? What concrete evidence could we point to? Just what happened in Daniel's favor in those verses, just things that you read right in there that happened, that went their way. Pardon? They looked healthier. Yeah, and actually the eunuch didn't, did he? But how does the eunuch, it does say that God gave Daniel favor with the eunuch. How did that work? Because the eunuch said, no, I fear for my life. It was steward, yeah. The way the eunuch, the way to look at that is the eunuch didn't report him. It was very well. I mean, he could have got mad and went off and said, you've got rebellion right here. But he didn't. God gave him favor with the eunuch. The eunuch actually opened up to Daniel about what he was afraid of regarding Daniel's request. And then somebody said the steward agreed to Daniel's proposal. Yeah, absolutely. And I think somebody said the test was a success in just 10 days. They were granted a change of diet. So right there, God is present with them and giving him and being gracious to them and maintaining their welfare. Even to these audacious teenage boys that want to have some sort of resistance, to offer some sort of resistance to total assimilation into the Babylonian culture. Pretty incredible. I think it speaks volumes to us and how we are to live. You know, it's just amazing to me the age of these guys and the incredible situation they're in, and they would act this bold and settle on their hearts, the way Daniel puts it, settle in their hearts. They're going to offer up whatever resistance they can to defiling themselves with total assimilation into the world of Babylon. So that speaks to me what I need to be about. Anybody have comments or questions? Yeah. Especially at work. Yep. Especially for those of us whose deepest idol is approval. I've got all my fingers pointing at me on that one. Any other question or comment? Next week we're going to finish this first chapter. I'm glad you asked that, Joe. So that means section 3, as well as, remember, the on pages 16 and 17, you're supposed to, on pages 14 through 16, read through gospel glimpses, whole Bible connections, and theological soundings. And then on pages 16 and 17, you're to share things that God impressed upon you or that jumped out at you after doing that. So we'll be going over the questions on page 13, 16, and 17 for next week.
So when you said section 3, not week 3.
Right. Yeah, he's got week 1 divided into 3 sections. So week 1, section 3. Chapter 1, verses 17 through 21. Daniel and his friends promoted and preserved. Okay. Then we'll get into chapter 2.